When she handed back the pad, without tearing off the sheet that now held her image, Patrick looked badly disappointed. "Nar, nar," said she, and in the voice of many, "only there's something I'd have you do before I take it for my pretty, for my precious, for my ever, to keep and know how I was at this where, at this when." She held out one of the pink rubber pieces, understanding now why Dandolo had cut them off, for he'd had his reasons. Patrick took what she offered and turned it over between his fingers, frowning, as if he had never seen such a thing before. Susanna was sure he had, but how many years ago? How close might he have come to disposing of his tormentor once and for all? And why hadn't Dandolo just killed him then? Because once he took away the erasers, he thought he was safe, she thought. Patrick was looking at her puzzled, beginning to be upset. Susanna sat down beside him and pointed at the blemish on the drawing. Then she put her fingers delicately around Patrick's wrist and drew it toward the paper. At first he resisted, then let his hand, with the pink nubbin in it, be tugged forward. She thought of the shadow on the land that hadn't been a shadow at all, but a herd of great, shaggy beasts Roland called Bannock. She thought of how she'd been able to smell the dust when Patrick began to draw the dust. And she thought of how, when Patrick had drawn the herd closer than it actually was, artistic license, and we all say thank you, it had actually looked closer. She remembered thinking that her eyes had adjusted and now marveled at her own stupidity, as if eyes could adjust to distance the way they could adjust to the dark. No. Patrick had moved them closer. Had moved them closer by drawing them closer. When the hand holding the eraser was almost touching the paper, she took her own hand away. This had to be all Patrick. She was somehow sure of it. She moved her fingers back and forth, miming what she wanted. He didn't get it. She did it again, then pointed to the sore beside the full lower lip. "Make it gone, Patrick," she said, surprised by the steadiness of her own voice. "It's ugly. Make it gone." Again she made that rubbing gesture in the air. "Erase it." This time he got it. She saw the light in his eyes. He held the pink nubbin up to her. Perfectly pink it was, not a smudge of graphite on it. He looked at her, eyebrows raised, as if to ask if she was sure. She nodded. Patrick lowered the eraser to the sore and began to rub it on the paper, tentatively at first. Then, as he saw what was happening, he worked with more spirit. 14. She felt the same queer, tingling sensation. But when he'd been drawing, it had been all over her. Now it was in only one place, to the right side of her mouth. As Patrick got the hang of the eraser and bore down with it, the tingling became a deep and monstrous itch. She had to clutch her hands deep into the dirt on either side of her to keep from reaching up and clawing at the sore, scratching it furiously, and never mind if she tore it wide open and sent a pint of blood gushing down her deerskin shirt. It'd be over in a few more seconds. It'd have to be. It'd have to be. Oh, dear God, please, let it end. Patrick, meanwhile, seemed to have forgotten all about her. He was looking down at his picture, his hair hanging to either side of his face and obscuring most of it, completely absorbed by this wonderful new toy. He erased delicately, then a little harder, the itch intensified, then more softly again. Susanna felt like shrieking. That itch was suddenly everywhere. It burned in her forebrain, buzzed across the wet surfaces of her eyes like twin clouds of gnats. It shivered at the very tips of her nipples, making them hopelessly hard. "I'll scream. I can't help it. I have to scream." She was drawing in her breath to do just that when suddenly the itch was gone. The pain was gone as well. She reached toward the side of her mouth, then hesitated. "I don't dare." "You better dare," Detta responded indignantly. "After all you've been through, all we've been through, you must have enough backbone left to touch your own damn face, you yellow bitch." She brought her fingers down to the skin. The smooth skin. The sore which had so troubled her since Thunderclap was gone. She knew that when she looked in a mirror or a still pool of water, she would not even see a scar. 15. Patrick worked a little longer, first with the eraser, then with the pencil, then with the eraser again, but Susanna felt no itch and not even a faint tingle. It was as though, once he had passed some critical point, the sensations just ceased. She wondered how old Patrick had been when Dandolo snipped all the erasers off the pencils. 4, 6? Young, anyway. She was sure that his original look of puzzlement when she showed him one of the erasers had been unfeigned, and yet, once he began, he used it like an old pro. Maybe it's like riding a bicycle, she thought. Once you learn how, you never forget. She waited as patiently as she could, and after 5 very long minutes, her patience was rewarded. Smiling, Patrick turned the pad around and showed her the picture. He had erased the blemish completely and then faintly shaded the area so that it looked like the rest of her skin. He had been careful to brush away every single crumb of rubber. "Very nice," she said. But that was a fairly shitty compliment to offer genius, wasn't it? So she leaned forward, put her arms around him, and kissed him firmly on the mouth. "Patrick, it's beautiful." The blood rushed so quickly and so strongly into his face that she was alarmed at first, wondering if he might not have a stroke in spite of his youth. But he was smiling as he held out the pad to her with one hand, making tearing gestures again with the other, wanting her to take it, wanting her to have it. Susanna tore it off very carefully, wondering in a dark back corner of her mind what would happen if she tore her right down the middle. She noted, as she did, that there was no amazement in his face, no astonishment, no fear. He had to have seen the sore beside her mouth, because the nasty thing had pretty much dominated her face for all the time he'd known her. And he had drawn it in near photographic detail. Now it was gone. Her exploring fingers told her so, yet Patrick wasn't registering any emotion, at least in regard to that. The conclusion seemed clear enough. When he'd erased it from his drawing, he'd also erased it from his own mind and memory. "Patrick?" He looked at her, smiling, happy that she was happy. And Susanna was very happy. The fact that she was also scared to death didn't change that in the slightest. "Will you draw something else for me?" He nodded, made a mark on his pad, then turned it around so she could see. A question mark. She looked at the question mark for a moment, then at him. She saw he was clutching the eraser, his wonderful new tool, very tightly. Susanna said, "I want you to draw me something that isn't there." He cocked his head quizzically to the side. She had to smile a little in spite of her rapidly thumping heart. Oi looked that way sometimes when he wasn't 100% sure what you meant. "Don't worry, I'll tell you." And she did, very carefully. Patrick listened. At some point, Roland heard Susanna's voice and awoke. He came over, looked at her in the dim red light of the embering campfire, started to look away, then snapped back, eyes widening. Until that moment, she hadn't been sure Roland would see what was no longer there either. She thought it at least possible that Patrick's magic would have been strong enough to erase it from the gunslinger's memory, too. "Susanna, thy face. What's happened to thy—" "Hush, Roland, if you love me." The gunslinger hushed. Susanna returned her attention to Patrick and began to speak again, quietly but urgently. Patrick listened, and as he did, she saw the light of understanding begin to enter his gaze. Roland replenished the fire without having to be asked, and soon their little camp was bright under the stars. Patrick wrote a question, putting it thriftily to the left of the question mark he had already drawn. "How tall?" Susanna took Roland by the elbow and positioned him in front of Patrick. The gunslinger stood about 6'3". She had him pick her up, then held a hand roughly 3 inches over his head. Patrick nodded, smiling. "And look you at something that has to be on it," she said, and took a branch from their little pile of brush. She broke it over her knee, creating a point of her own. She could remember the symbols, but it would be best if she didn't think about them overmuch. She sensed they had to be absolutely right, or the door she wanted him to make for her would either open on some place she didn't want to go, or would not open at all. Therefore, once she began to draw in the mixed dirt and ash by the campfire, she did it as rapidly as Patrick himself might have done, not pausing long enough to cast her eye back upon a single symbol. For if she looked back at one, she would surely look back at all, and she would see something that looked wrong to her, and uncertainty would set in like a sickness. Detta, brash, foul-mouthed Detta, who had turned out on more than one occasion to be her savior, might step in and take over, finish for her, but she couldn't count on that. On her heart's deepest level, she still did not entirely trust Detta not to send everything to blazes at a crucial moment, and for no other reason than the black joy of the thing. Nor did she fully trust Roland, who might want to keep her for reasons he did not fully understand himself. So she drew quickly in the dirt and ashes, not looking back, and these were the symbols that flowed away beneath the flying tip of her makeshift implement. "Unfound," Roland breathed. "Susanna, what? How?"
"Hush," she repeated.
Patrick bent over his pad and began to draw. 16. She kept looking around for the door, but the circle of light thrown by their fire was very small, even after Roland had set it to blazing. Small compared to the vast darkness of the prairie, at least. She saw nothing. When she turned to Roland, she could see the unspoken question in his eyes, and so, while Patrick kept working, she showed him the picture of her the young man had drawn. She indicated the place where the blemish had been. Holding the page close to his face, Roland at last saw the eraser's marks. Patrick had concealed what few traces he'd left behind with great cunning, and Roland had found them only with the closest scrutiny. It was like casting for an old trail after many days of rain. "No wonder the old man cut off his erasers," he said, giving the picture back to her.
"That's what I thought."
From there she skipped ahead to her single, true, intuitive leap, that if Patrick could, in this world at least, uncreate by erasing, he might be able to create by drawing. When she mentioned the herd of bannock that had seemed mysteriously closer, Roland rubbed his forehead like a man who has a nasty headache. "I should have seen that. Should have realized what it meant, too. Susanna, I'm getting old." She ignored that she'd heard it before, and told him about the dreams of Eddie and Jake, being sure to mention the product names on the sweatshirts, the choral voices, the offer of hot chocolate, and the growing panic in their eyes as the nights passed, and still she did not see what the dream had been sent to show her.
"Why didn't you tell me this dream before now?" Roland asked. "Why didn't you ask for help in interpreting it?"
She looked at him steadily, thinking she had been right not to ask for his help. Yes, no matter how much that might hurt him.
"You've lost, too. How eager would you have been to lose me as well?"
He flushed. Even in the firelight she could see it. "Thee speaks ill of me, Susanna, and have thought worse."
"Perhaps I have," she said. "If so, I say sorry. I wasn't sure of what I wanted myself. Part of me wants to see the tower, you know. Part of me wants that very badly, and even if Patrick can draw the unfound door into existence and I can open it, it's not the real world it opens on. That's what the names on the shirts mean, I'm sure of it."
"You mustn't think that," Roland said. "Reality is seldom a thing of black and white, I think, of is and isn't, be and not be."
Patrick made a hooting sound, and they both looked. He was holding his pad up, turned toward them, so they could see what he had drawn. It was a perfect representation of the unfound door, she thought. The artist wasn't printed on it, and the doorknob was plain, shiny metal. No crossed pencils adorned it, but that was all right. She hadn't bothered to tell him about those things, which had been for her benefit and understanding.
"They did everything but draw me a map," she thought.
She wondered why everything had to be so damn hard, so damn riddledy-dum mysterious, and knew that was a question to which she would never find a satisfactory answer. Except it was the human condition, wasn't it? The answers that mattered never came easily. Patrick made another of those hooting noises. This time it had an interrogative quality. She suddenly realized that the poor kid was practically dying of anxiety, and why not? He had just executed his first commission, and wanted to know what his patrono d'arte thought of it.
"It's great, Patrick, terrific.
Yes, Roland agreed, taking the pad.
The door looked to him exactly like those he'd found as he staggered along the beach of the Western Sea, delirious and dying of the lobstrosity's poisoned bite. It was as if the poor tongueless creature had looked into his head and seen an actual picture of that door, a photograph.
Susanna, meanwhile, was looking around desperately. And when she began to swing along on her hands toward the edge of the firelight, Roland had to call her back sharply, reminding her that Mordred might be out there anywhere, and the darkness was Mordred's friend. Impatient as she was, she retreated from the edge of the light, remembering all too well what had happened to Mordred's body mother and how quickly it had happened. It had hurt to pull back, almost physically. Roland had told her that he expected to catch his first glimpse of the Dark Tower toward the end of the coming day. If she was still with him, if she saw it with him, she thought its power might prove too strong for her, its glamour. Now, given a choice between the door and the tower, she knew she could still choose the door. But as they drew closer and the power of the tower grew stronger, its pulse deeper and more compelling in her mind, the singing voices ever sweeter, choosing the door would be harder to do.
"I don't see it," she said despairingly. "Maybe I was wrong. Maybe there is no damn door. Oh, Roland!"
"I don't think you were wrong," Roland told her.
He spoke with obvious reluctance, but as a man will when he has a job to do or a debt to repay. And he did owe this woman a debt, he reckoned. For had he not pretty much seized her by the scruff of the neck and hauled her into this world, where she'd learned the art of murder and fallen in love and been left bereaved? Had he not kidnapped her into this present sorrow? If he could make that right, he had an obligation to do so. His desire to keep her with him, and at the risk of her own life, was pure selfishness, and unworthy of his training. More important than that, it was unworthy of how much he had come to love and respect her. It broke what remained of his heart to think of bidding her goodbye, the last of his strange and wonderful quartet. But if it was what she wanted, what she needed, then he must do it. And he thought he could do it, for he had seen something about the young man's drawing that Susanna had missed. Not something that was there, something that wasn't. "Look thee," he said gently, showing her the picture. "Do you see how hard he's tried to please thee, Susanna?"
"Yes," she said. "Yes, of course I do, but—"
"It took him 10 minutes to do this, I should judge. And most of his drawings, good as they are the work of 3 or 4 at most, wouldn't you say?"
"I don't understand you," she nearly screamed this.
Patrick drew Oi to him and wrapped an arm around the bumbler, all the while looking at Susanna and Roland with wide, unhappy eyes.
"He worked so hard to give you what you want that there's only the door. It stands by itself, all alone on the paper. It has no... no—" he searched for the right word. Vanay's ghost whispered it dryly into his ear. "It has no context."
For a moment Susanna continued to look puzzled, and then the light of understanding began to break in her eyes. Roland didn't wait. He simply dropped his good left hand on Patrick's shoulder and told him to put the door behind Susanna's little electric golf cart, which she had taken to calling Hofat 3. Patrick was happy to oblige. For one thing, putting Hofat 3 in front of the door gave him a reason to use his eraser. He worked much more quickly this time, almost carelessly, an observer might have said, but the gunslinger was sitting right next to him and didn't think Patrick missed a single stroke in his depiction of the little cart. He finished by drawing its single front wheel and putting a reflected gleam of firelight in the hubcap. Then he put his pencil down, and as he did, there was a disturbance in the air. Roland felt it push against his face. The flames of the fire, which had been burning straight up in the windless dark, streamed briefly sideways. Then the feeling was gone. The flames once more burned straight up. And standing not 10 feet from that fire, behind the electric cart, was a door Roland had last encountered in Calibryn Sturgis, in the Cave of the Voices. 17. Susanna waited until dawn,
at first passing the time by gathering up her gunna, then putting it aside again. What would her few possessions, not to mention the little hide bag in which they were stored, avail her in New York City? People would laugh. They would probably laugh anyway, or scream and run at the very sight of her. The Susanna Dean, who suddenly appeared in Central Park, would look to most folks not like a college graduate or an heiress to a large fortune. Not even like Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, say sorry. No, to civilized city people, she'd probably look like some kind of freak show escapee. And once she went through this door, would there be any going back? Never. Never in life. So she put her gunna aside and simply waited. As dawn began to show its first faint white light on the horizon, she called Patrick over and asked him if he wanted to go along with her. Back to the world you came from, or one very much like it, she told him, although she knew he didn't remember that world at all. Either he'd been taken from it too young, or the trauma of being snatched away had erased his memory. Patrick looked at her, then at Roland, who was squatted on his hunkers, looking at him.
"Either way, son," the gunslinger said. "You can draw on either world, tell you true. Although where she's going, there'll be more to appreciate it."
He wants him to stay, she thought, and was angry. Then Roland looked at her and gave his head a minute shake. She wasn't sure, but she thought that meant... And no, she didn't just think. She knew what it meant. Roland wanted her to know he was hiding his thoughts from Patrick, his desires. And while she'd known the gunslinger to lie, most spectacularly at the meeting on the Colibrinsturges common ground before the coming of the wolves, she had never known him to lie to her. To Detta, maybe, but not to her, or Eddie, or Jake. There had been times when he hadn't told them all he knew, but outright lie? No. They'd been quartet, and Roland had played them straight. Give the devil his due. Patrick suddenly took up his pad and wrote quickly on the clean sheet, then he showed it to them. "I will stay. Scared to go someplace new." As if to emphasize exactly what he meant, he opened his lips and pointed into his tongueless mouth. And did she see relief on Roland's face? If so, she hated him for it. "All right, Patrick," she said, trying to show none of her feelings in her voice. She even reached over and patted his hand. "I understand how you feel. And while it's true that people can be cruel, cruel and mean, there's plenty who are kind. Listen, Vee, I am not going until dawn. If you change your mind, the offer is open." He nodded quickly. "Grateful I ain't gonna try no harder to change his mind," Detta thought angrily. "Old white man probably grateful too." "Shut up," Susanna told her. And for a wonder, Detta did. 18. But as the day brightened, revealing a medium-sized herd of grazing bannock not 2 miles away, she let Detta back into her mind. More, she let Detta take over. It was easier that way, less painful. It was Detta who took one more stroll around the campsite, briskly breathing the last of this world for both of them, and storing away the memory. It was Detta who went around the door, rocking first one way and then the other on the toughened pads of her palms, and saw the nothing at all on the other side. Patrick walked on one side of her, Roland on the other. Patrick hooted with surprise when he saw the door was gone. Roland said nothing. Oi walked up to the place where the door had been, sniffed at the air, and then walked through the place where it was, if you were looking from the other side. "If we was over there," Detta thought, "we'd see him walk right through it, like a magic trick." She returned to Hofat 3, which she had decided to ride through the door, always assuming it would open, that was. This whole business would be quite a joke if it turned out it wouldn't. Roland made to help her up into the seat. She brushed him brusquely away and mounted on her own. She pushed the red button beside the wheel, and the cart's electric motor started with a faint hum. The needle-marked charge still swung well over into the green. She turned the throttle on the right handlebar and rolled slowly toward the closed door with the symbols meaning unfound marching across the front. She stopped, with the cart's little bullet nose almost touching it. She turned to the gunslinger with a fixed, make-believe smile.
All right, Roland. I'll say goodbye to you, then. Long days and pleasant nights. May you reach your damn tower and—
No, he said.
She looked at him. Detta looked at him with her eyes both blazing and laughing, challenging him to turn this into something she didn't want it to be. Challenging him to turn her out now that she was in.
Come on, honky white boy, let's see you do it.
What?
She asked. What's on your mind, big boy?
I'd not say goodbye to you like this, after all this time, he said.
What you mean?
You know.
She shook her head defiantly.
Don't.
For one thing, he said, taking her trail-toughened left hand gently in his mutilated right one, there's another who should have the choice to go or stay, and I'm not speaking of Patrick.
For a moment she didn't understand. Then she looked down at a certain pair of gold-ringed eyes, a certain pair of cocked ears, and did. She had forgotten about Oi.
If Detta asks him, he'll surely stay, for she's never been to his liking. If Susanna asks him, why then I don't know.
Just like that, Detta was gone. She would be back. Susanna understood now that she would never be entirely free of Detta Walker, and that was all right, because she no longer wanted to be. But for now, she was gone.
Oi, she said gently, will you come with me, honey? It may be we'll find Jake again. Maybe not quite the same, but still.
Oi, who had been almost completely silent during their trek across the Badlands and the White Lands of Empathica and the Open Rangelands, now spoke.
Ake?
He said. But he spoke doubtfully, as one who barely remembers, and her heart broke. She had promised herself she wouldn't cry, and Detta all but guaranteed she wouldn't cry. But now Detta was gone, and the tears were here again.
Jake, she said. You remember Jake, Honeybunch? I know you do. Jake and Eddie?
Ake? Ed?
With a little more certainty now, he did remember.
Come with me,
she urged, and Oi started forward as if he would jump up in the cart beside her. Then, with no idea at all why she should say it, she added, there are other worlds than these. Oi stopped as soon as the words were out of her mouth. He sat down. Then he got up again, and she felt a moment of hope. Perhaps there could still be some little Ka-Tet. A Dantiti-Tet in some version of New York where folks drove Takuro spirits and took pictures of each other drinking Nazola with their Shinaro cameras. Instead, Oi trotted back to the gunslinger and sat beside one battered boot. They had walked far, those boots, far. Miles and wheels, wheels and miles. But now their walking was almost done.
Olin, said Oi.
And the finality in his strange little voice rolled a stone against her heart. She turned bitterly to the old man with the big iron on his hip.
There, she said, you have your own glamour, don't you? Always did. You drew Eddie on to one death and Jake to a pair of them. Now Patrick and even the Bumbler. Are you happy?
No, said he, and she saw he truly was not. She believed she had never seen such sadness and such loneliness on a human face. Never was I farther from happy, Susanna of New York. Will you change your mind and stay? Will thee come the last little while with me? That would make me happy.
For a wild moment, she thought she would. That she would simply turn the little electric cart from the door, which was one-sided and made no promises, and go with him to the Dark Tower. Another day would do it. They could camp at mid-afternoon and thus arrive tomorrow at sunset, as he wanted. Then she remembered the dream, the singing voices, the young man holding out the cup of hot chocolate, the good kind, Mitschlag.
No, she said softly. I'll take my chance and go.
For a moment she thought he would make it easy on her, just agree and let her go. Then his anger, no, his despair, broke in a painful burst.
But you can't be sure, Susanna, what if the dream itself is a trick and a glamour? What if the things you see even when the doors open are nothing but tricks and glamours? What if you roll right through and into Todash space?
Then I'll light the darkness with thoughts of those I love.
And that might work, said he, speaking in the bitterest voice she had ever heard. For the first 10 years, or 20, or even 100. And then, what about the rest of eternity? Think of Oi. Do you think he's forgotten Jake? Never, never, never in your life, never in his. He senses something wrong. Susanna, don't, I beg you, don't go. I'll get on my knees if that will help.
And to her horror, he began to do exactly that. It won't, she said. And if this is to be my last sight of you, my heart says it is, then don't let it be of you on your knees. You're not a kneeling man, Roland, son of Stephen, never were, and I don't want to remember you that way. I want to see you on your feet, as you were in Colibrin Sturgis, as you were with your friends at Jericho Hill.
He got up and came to her. For a moment, she thought he meant to restrain her by force, and she was afraid. But he only put his hand on her arm for a moment, and then took it away. Let me ask you again, Susanna. Are you sure? She conned her heart, and saw that she was. She understood the risks, but yes, she was. And why? Because Roland's way was the way of the gun. Roland's way was death for those who rode or walked beside him. He had proved it over and over again since the earliest days of his quest, no, even before, since overhearing Hax the cook plotting treachery and thus assuring his death by the rope. It was all for the good, for what he called the white, she had no doubt of it. But Eddie still lay in his grave in one world, and Jake in another. She had no doubt that much the same fate was waiting for Oi, and for poor Patrick. Nor would their deaths be long in coming.
I'm sure, said she.
All right. Will you give me a kiss?
She took him by the arm and pulled him down and put her lips on his. When she inhaled, she took in the breath of 1,000 years and 10,000 miles. And yes, she tasted death.
But not for you, Gunslinger, she thought. For others, but never for you. May I escape your glamour, and may I do fine.
She was the one who broke their kiss.
Can you open the door for me?
She asked. Roland went to it, and took the knob in his hand, and the knob turned easily within his grip. Cold air puffed out, strong enough to blow Patrick's long hair back, and with it came a few flakes of snow. She could see grass that was still green beneath light frost, and a path, and an iron fence. Voices were singing, "What child is this?" just as in her dream. It could be Central Park. Yes, it could be Central Park of some other world along the Axis, perhaps, and not the one she came from, but close enough so that in time she would know no difference. Or perhaps it was, as he said, a glamour. Perhaps it was the Todash darkness.
It could be a trick, he said, most certainly reading her mind.
Life is a trick, love a glamour, she replied. Perhaps we'll meet again, in the clearing at the end of the path.
As you say so, let it be so, he told her.
He put out one leg, the run-down heel of his boot planted in the earth, and bowed to her. Oi had begun to weep, but he sat firmly beside the gunslinger's left boot. Goodbye, my dear.
Goodbye, Roland.
Then she faced ahead, took in a deep breath, and twisted the little cart's throttle. It rolled smoothly forward.
Wait! Roland cried.
But she never turned, nor looked at him again. She rolled through the door. It slammed shut behind her at once with a flat, declamatory clap he knew all too well. One he'd dreamed of ever since his long and feverish walk along the edge of the Western Sea. The sound of the singing was gone, and now there was only the lonely sound of the prairie wind. Roland of Gilead sat in front of the door, which already looked tired and unimportant. It would never open again. He put his face in his hands. It occurred to him that if he had never loved them, he would never have felt so alone as this. Yet of all his many regrets, the reopening of his heart was not among them, even now. 19. Later, because there's always a later, isn't there? He made breakfast and forced himself to eat his share. Patrick ate heartily, then withdrew to do his necessary while Roland packed up. There was a third plate, and it was still full.
"Oi?" Roland asked, tipping it toward the Billy Bumbler. "Will you not have at least a bite?"
Oi looked at the plate, then backed away two firm steps. Roland nodded and tossed away the uneaten food, scattering it into the grass. Mayhap Mordred would come along in good time and find something to his liking. At mid-morning they moved on, Roland pulling Hofat too, and Patrick walking along beside with his head hung low. And soon, the beat of the tower filled the gunslinger's head again, very close now. That steady, pulsing power drove out all thoughts of Susanna, and he was glad. He gave himself to the steady beating and let it sweep away all his thoughts and all his sorrow. "Kamala, come, come," sang the dark tower, now just over the horizon. "Kamala, come, come. Gunslinger, may you come. Kamala, come, Roland. The journey's nearly done." Chapter 2 Mordred 1 The Dan Tiri was watching, when the long-haired fellow they were now traveling with grabbed Susanna's shoulder to point out the dancing orange hobs in the distance. Mordred watched as she whirled, pulling one of the White Daddy's big revolvers. For a moment, the far-seeing glass eyes he'd found in the house on Odd's Lane trembled in Mordred's hand. That was how hard he was rooting for his blackbird mommy to shoot the artist. How the guilt would have bitten into her. Like the blade of a dull hatchet, yar. It was even possible that, overcome by the horror of what she had done, she'd have put the barrel of the gun to her own head and pulled the trigger a second time, and how would old White Daddy like waking up to that? Ah, children are such dreamers. It didn't happen, of course, but there had been much more to watch. Some of it was hard to see, though, because it wasn't just excitement that made the binoculars tremble. He was dressed warmly now, in layers of Dandolo's Hume clothes, but he was still cold, except when he was hot. And either way, hot or cold, he trembled like a toothless old gaffer in a chimney corner. This state of affairs had been growing gradually worse since he left Joe Collins's house behind. Fever roared in his bones like a blizzard wind. Mordred was no longer a hungry, for Mordred no longer had an appetite. But Mordred was a sick. A sick. A sick. In truth, he was afraid Mordred might be a dying. Nonetheless, he watched Roland's party with great interest. And once the fire was replenished, he saw even better, saw the door come into being, although he could not read the symbols there writ upon. He understood that the artist had somehow drawn it into being. What a godlike talent that was! Mordred longed to eat him just on the chance such a talent might be transmittable. He doubted it. The spiritual side of cannibalism was greatly overrated. But what harm in seeing for oneself? He watched their palaver. He saw, and also understood, her plea to the artist and the mutt, her whining entreaties. "Come with me so I don't have to go alone. Come on, be a sport. In fact, be a couple of sports. Oh, boo-hoo!" And rejoiced in her sorrow and fury when the plea was rejected by both boy and beast. Mordred rejoiced, even though he knew it would make his own job harder. A little harder, anyway. How much trouble could a mute young man and a Billy Bumbler really give him, once he changed his shape and made his move? For a moment he thought that, in her anger, she might shoot old White Daddy with his own gun, and that Mordred did not want. Old White Daddy was meant to be his. The voice from the Dark Tower had told him so. A sick he surely was, a dying he might be, but old White Daddy was still meant to be his meal, not the Blackbird Mommy's. Why, she'd leave the meat to rot without taking a single bite. But she didn't shoot him. Instead, she kissed him. Mordred didn't want to see that. It made him feel sicker than ever, and so he put the binoculars aside. He lay in the grass, amid a little clump of alders, trembling, hot and cold, trying not to puke. He had spent the entire previous day puking and shitting, it seemed, until the muscles of his midsection ached with the strain of sending such heavy traffic in two directions at once, and nothing came up his throat but thick, mucousy strings, and nothing out of his backside but brown stew and great, hollow farts. And when he looked through the binoculars again, it was just in time to see the back end of the little electric cart disappear as the blackbird mommy drove it through the door. Something swirled out around it. Dust, maybe? But he thought snow. There was also singing. The sound of it made him feel almost as sick as seeing her kiss old white gunslinger daddy. Then the door slammed shut behind her, and the singing was gone, and the gunslinger just sat there near it with his face in his hands, boo-hoo, sob, sob. The bumbler went to him and put its long snout on one of his boots, as if to offer comfort. How sweet, how puking sweet. By then it was dawn, and Mordred dozed a little. When he woke up, it was to the sound of old white daddy's voice. Mordred's hiding place was downwind, and the words came to him clearly. "Oi, will you not have at least a bite?" The bumbler would not, however, and the gunslinger had scattered the food that had been meant for the little furry howkin. Later, after they moved on, old white gunslinger daddy pulling the cart the robot had made for them, plodding slowly along the ruts of Tower Road, with his head down and his shoulders all a slump, Mordred crept to the campsite. He did indeed eat some of the scattered food. Surely it had not been poisoned if Roland had hoped it would go down the bumbler's gullet. But he stopped after only 3 or 4 chunks of meat, knowing that if he went on eating, his guts would spew everything back out, both north and south. He couldn't have that. If he didn't hold on to at least some nourishment, he would be too weak to follow them. And he must follow. Had to stay close a little while longer. It would have to be tonight. It would have to be, because tomorrow old white daddy would reach the Dark Tower, and then it would almost certainly be too late. His heart told him so. Mordred plodded as Roland had, but even more slowly. Every now and then he would double over as cramps seized him and his human shape wavered, that blackness rising and receding under his skin, his heavy coat bulging restlessly as the other legs tried to burst free, then hanging slack again as he willed them back inside, gritting his teeth and groaning with effort. Once he shit a pint or so of stinky brown fluid in his pants, and once he managed to get his trousers down, and he cared little either way. No one had invited him to the Reap Ball, ha-ha. Invitation lost in the mail, no doubt. Later, when it came time to attack, he would let the little Red King free. But if it happened now, he was almost positive he wouldn't be able to change back again. He wouldn't have the strength. The spider's faster metabolism would fan the sickness the way a strong wind fans a low ground fire into a forest gobbling blaze. What was killing him slowly would kill him rapidly instead. So he fought it, and by afternoon he felt a little better. The pulse from the tower was growing rapidly now, growing in strength and urgency. So was his red daddy's voice, urging him on, urging him to stay within striking distance. Old white gunslinger daddy had gotten no more than 4 hours sleep a night for weeks now, because he had been standing watch and watch with the now departed Blackbird Mommy. But Blackbird Mommy hadn't ever had to pull that cart, had she? No. Just rode in it like Queen Shit of Turd Hill, did she? He. Which meant old white gunslinger daddy was plenty tired. Even with the pulse of the Dark Tower to buoy him up and pull him onward. Tonight old white daddy would either have to depend on the artist and the mutt to stand the first watch, or try to do the whole thing on his own. Mordred thought he could stand one more wakeful night himself, simply because he knew he'd never have to have another. He would creep close, as he had the previous night. He would watch their camp with the old man-monster's glass eyes for far-seeing. And when they were all asleep, he would change for the last time and rush down upon them. Scrabble-de-dee comes me, he. Old white daddy might never even wake up. but Mordred hoped he would. At the very end, just long enough to realize what was happening to him. Just long enough to know that his son was snatching him into the land of death only hours before he would have reached his precious Dark Tower. Mordred clenched his fists and watched the fingers turn black. He felt a terrible but pleasurable itching up the sides of his body as the spider legs tried to burst through, 7 instead of 8, thanks to the terrible, nasty, awful blackbird mommy who had been both preg and not preg at the same time. And might she rot screaming in Todash space forever, or at least until one of the great ones who lurked there found her. He fought and encouraged the change with equal ferocity. At last he only fought it, and the urge to change subsided. He gave out a victory fart, but although this one was long and smelly, it was silent. His asshole was now a broken squeeze box that could no longer make music but only gasp. His fingers returned to their normal pinkish-white shade, and the itching up and down the sides of his body disappeared. His head swam and slithered with fever, his thin arms, little more than sticks, ached with chills. The voice of his red daddy was sometimes loud and sometimes faint, but it was always there. "Come to me, run to me, hide thy doubleton self. Come, Kamala, you good son of mine. We'll bring the tower down, we'll destroy all the light there is, and then rule the darkness together. Come to me, come." 2. Surely those three who remained, 4 counting himself, had outrun Ka's umbrella. Not since the Prim receded had there been such a creature as Mordred Deshane, who was part Hume and part of that rich and potent soup. Surely such a creature could never have been meant by Ka to die such a mundane death as the one that now threatened, fever brought on by food poisoning. Roland could have told him that eating what he found in the snow around to the side of Dandelo's barn was a bad idea. So could Robert Browning, for that matter. Wicked or not, actual horse or not, Lippy, probably named after another and better-known Browning poem called Fra Lippo Lippi, had been a sick animal herself when Roland ended her life with a bullet to the head. But Mordred had been in his spider form when he'd come upon the thing which at least looked like a horse. And almost nothing would have stopped him from eating the meat. It wasn't until he'd resumed his human form again that he wondered uneasily how there could be so much meat on Dandelo's bony old nag, and why it had been so soft and warm, so full of uncoagulated blood. It had been in a snowdrift, after all, and had been lying there for some days. The mare's remains should have been frozen stiff. Then the vomiting began. The fever came next, and with it, the struggle not to change until he was close enough to his old white daddy to rip him limb from limb. The being, whose coming had been prophesied for thousands of years, mostly by the Manny folk and usually in frightened whispers, the being who would grow to be half-human and half-god, the being who would oversee the end of humanity and the return of the Prim, that being had finally arrived as a naive and bad-hearted child who was now dying from a bellyful of poisoned horse meat. Ka could have had no part in this. 3. Roland and his two companions didn't make much progress on the day Susanna left them. Even had he not planned to travel short miles so that they could come to the tower at sunset of the day following, Roland wouldn't have been able to go far. He was disheartened, lonely, and tired almost to death. Patrick was also tired, but he at least could ride if he chose to. And for most of that day he did so choose, sometimes napping, sometimes sketching, sometimes walking a little while before climbing back into Hofat II and napping some more. The pulse from the tower was strong in Roland's head and heart, and its song was powerful and lovely, now seemingly composed of 1,000 voices, but not even these things could take the lead from his bones. Then, as he was looking for a shady spot where they could stop and eat a little midday meal, by now it was actually mid-afternoon, he saw something that momentarily made him forget both his weariness and his sorrow. Growing by the side of the road was a wild rose, seemingly the exact twin of the one in the vacant lot. It bloomed in defiance of the season, which Roland put as very early spring. It was a light pink shade on the outside and darkened to a fierce red on the inside. The exact color, he thought, of heart's desire. He fell on his knees before it, tipped his ear toward that coral cup, and listened. The rose was singing. The weariness stayed, as weariness will, on this side of the grave at least, but the loneliness and the sadness departed, at least for a little while. He peered into the heart of the rose and saw a yellow center so bright he couldn't look directly at it. Gan's Gateway, he thought, not sure exactly what that was, but positive that he was right. Aye, Gan's Gateway, so it is. This was unlike the rose in the vacant lot in one crucial way. The feeling of sickness and the faint voices of discord were gone. This one was rich with health, as well as full of light and love. It and all the others, they feed the beams, don't they? With their songs and their perfume, as the beams feed them. It's a living force field, a giving and taking, all spinning out from the tower. And this is only the first, the farthest outrider. In Cancanore, there are tens of thousands just like this. The thought made him faint with amazement. Then came another that filled him with anger and fear. The only one with a view of that great red blanket was insane. Would blight them all in an instant if allowed free rein to do so. There was a hesitant tap on his shoulder. It was Patrick, with Oi at his heel. Patrick pointed to the grassy area beside the rose, then made eating gestures. Pointed at the rose, and made drawing motions. Roland wasn't very hungry, but the boy's other idea pleased him a great deal. Yes, he said, we'll have a bite here. Then maybe I'll take me a little siesta while you draw the rose. Will you make two pictures of it, Patrick? He showed the two remaining fingers on his right hand to make sure Patrick understood. The young man frowned and cocked his head, still not understanding. His hair hung to one shoulder in a bright sheaf. Roland thought of how Susanna had washed that hair in a stream in spite of Patrick's hooted protests. It was the sort of thing Roland himself would never have thought to do, but it made the young fellow look a lot better. Looking at that sheaf of shining hair made him miss Susanna in spite of the rose's song. She had brought grace to his life. It wasn't a word that had occurred to him until she was gone. Meanwhile, here was Patrick, wildly talented, but awfully slow on the uptake. Roland gestured to his pad, then to the rose. Patrick nodded. That part he got. Then Roland raised two of the fingers on his good hand and pointed to the pad again. This time the light broke on Patrick's face. He pointed to the rose, to the pad, to Roland, and then to himself. That's right, big boy, Roland said. A picture of the rose for you and one for me. It's nice, isn't it? Patrick nodded enthusiastically, setting to work while Roland rustled the grub. Once again Roland fixed three plates, and once again Oi refused his share. When Roland looked into the bumbler's gold-ringed eyes, he saw an emptiness there, a kind of loss that hurt him deep inside. And Oi couldn't stand to miss many meals, he was far too thin already. Trail frayed, Cuthbert would have said, probably smiling. In need of some hot sassafras and salts. But the gunslinger had no sassy here. Why do you look so? Roland asked the bumbler crossly. If you wanted to go with her, they should have gone when they had the chance. Why will ye cast thy sad Hawkins eyes on me now? Oi looked at him a moment longer, and Roland saw that he had hurt the little fellow's feelings. Ridiculous, but true. Oi walked away, little squiggle of tail drooping. Roland felt like calling him back, but that would have been more ridiculous yet, would it not? What plan did he have? To apologize to a Billy Bumbler? He felt angry and ill at ease with himself. Feelings he had never suffered before hauling Eddie, Susanna, and Jake from America's side into his life.
Before they'd come, he'd felt almost nothing. And while that was a narrow way to live, in some ways it wasn't so bad. At least you didn't waste time wondering if you should apologize to animals for taking a high tone to them by the gods. Roland hunkered by the rose, leaning into the soothing power of its song and the blaze of light, healthy light, from its center. Then Patrick hooted at him, gesturing for Roland to move away so he could see it and draw it. This added to Roland's sense of dislocation and annoyance, but he moved back without a word of protest. He had, after all, asked Patrick to draw it, hadn't he? He thought of how, if Susanna had been here, their eyes would have met with amused understanding, as the eyes of parents do over the antics of a small child. But she wasn't here, of course. She'd been the last of them, and now she was gone, too. "All right, can you see how get Rosengaff a tweak it better?" he asked, striving to sound comic and only sounding cross. Cross and tired. Patrick, at least, didn't react to the harshness in the gunslinger's tone. "Probably didn't even ken what I said," Roland thought. The mute boy sat with his ankles crossed and his pad balanced on his thighs, his half-finished plate of food set off to one side. "Don't get so busy you forget to eat that," Roland said. "You mind me now." He got another distracted nod for his pains and gave up. "I'm going to snooze, Patrick. It'll be a long afternoon, and an even longer night," he added to himself. And yet he had the same consolation as Mordred. Tonight would likely be the last. He didn't know for sure what waited for him in the Dark Tower at the end of the Field of Roses, but even if he managed to put paid to the Crimson King, he felt quite sure that this was his last march. He didn't believe he would ever leave Can Ka-Noure, and that was all right. He was very tired, and despite the power of the rose, sad. Roland of Gilead put an arm over his eyes and was asleep at once. 4. He didn't sleep for long before Patrick woke him with a child's enthusiasm to show him the first picture of the rose he'd drawn. The sun suggested no more than 10 minutes had passed, 15 at most. Like all of his drawings, this one had a queer power. Patrick had captured the rose almost to the life, even though he had nothing but a pencil to work with. Still, Roland would much have preferred another hour's sleep to this exercise in art appreciation. He nodded his approval, though. No more grouch and grump in the presence of such a lovely thing, he promised himself. And Patrick smiled, happy even with so little. He tossed back the sheet and began drawing the rose again. One picture for each of them, just as Roland had asked. Roland could have slept again, but what was the point? The mute boy would be done with the second picture in a matter of minutes, and would only wake him again. He went to Oi instead, and stroked the bumbler's dense fur, something he rarely did. "I'm sorry I spoke rough to you, fella," Roland said. "Will you not set me on with a word?" But Oi would not. 15 minutes later, Roland repacked the few things he'd taken out of the cart, spat into his palms, and hoisted the handles again. The cart was lighter now, had to be, but it felt heavier. "Of course it's heavier," he thought. "It's got my grief in it. I pull it along with me everywhere I go, so I do." Soon Hofat, too, had Patrick Danville in it as well. He crawled up, made himself a little nest, and fell asleep almost at once. Roland plodded on, head down, shadow growing longer at his heels. Oi walked beside him. "One more night," the gunslinger thought. "One more night, one more day to follow. And then it's done, one way or t'other." He let the pulse of the tower and its many singing voices fill his head and lighten his heels at least a little. There were more roses now, dozens scattered on either side of the road and brightening the otherwise dull countryside. A few were growing in the road itself, and he was careful to detour around them. Tired though he might be, he would not crush a single one, or roll a wheel over a single fallen petal. 5. He stopped for the night,
While the sun was still well above the horizon, too weary to go farther even though there would be at least another 2 hours of daylight. Here was a stream that had gone dry, but in its bed grew a riot of those beautiful wild roses. Their songs didn't diminish his weariness, but they revived his spirit to some extent. He thought this was true for Patrick and Oi as well, and that was good. When Patrick had awakened, he looked around eagerly at first. Then his face had darkened, and Roland knew he was realizing all over again that Susanna was gone. The boy had cried a little then, but perhaps there would be no crying here. There was a grove of cottonwood trees on the bank. At least the gunslinger thought they were cottonwoods, but they had died when the stream from which their roots drank had disappeared. Now their branches were only bony, leafless snarls against the sky. In their silhouettes he could make out the number 19 over and over again, in both the figures of Susanna's world and those of his own. In one place, the branches seemed to clearly spell the word Chasset against the deepening sky. Before making a fire and cooking them an early supper, canned goods from Dandolo's pantry would do well enough tonight, he reckoned. Roland went into the dry stream bed and smelled the roses, strolling slowly among the dead trees and listening to their song. Both the smell and the sound were refreshing. Feeling a little better, he gathered wood from beneath the trees, snapping off a few of the lower branches for good measure, leaving dry, splintered stumps that reminded him a little of Patrick's pencils, and piled kindling in the center. Then he struck a light, speaking the old catechism almost without hearing it. Spark a dark, who's my sire? Will I lay me, will I stay me? Bless this camp with fire. While he waited for the fire to first grow and then die down to a bed of rosy embers, Roland took out the watch he had been given in New York. Yesterday it had stopped, although he had been assured the battery that ran it would last for 50 years. Now, as late afternoon faded to evening, the hands had very slowly begun to move backward. He looked at this for a little while, fascinated, then closed the cover and looked at the sigils inscribed there, Key and Rose and Tower. A faint and eldritch blue light had begun to gleam from the windows that spiraled upward. They didn't know it would do that, he thought, and then put the watch carefully back in his left-hand front pocket, checking first, as he always did, that there was no hole for it to fall through. Then he cooked. He and Patrick ate well. Oi would touch not a single bite. 6. Other than the night he had spent in palaver with the man in black, the night during which Walter had read a bleak fortune from an undoubtedly stacked deck, those 12 hours of dark by the dry stream were the longest of Roland's life. The weariness settled over him ever deeper and darker until it felt like a cloak of stones. Old faces and old places marched in front of his heavy eyes. Susan, riding hell-bent across the drop, with her blonde hair flying out behind. Cuthbert, running down the side of Jericho Hill in much the same fashion, screaming and laughing. Alan Johns, raising a glass and a toast. Eddie and Jake, wrestling in the grass, yelling, while Oi danced around them, barking. Mordred was somewhere out there, and close. Yet again and again, Roland found himself drifting toward sleep. Each time he jerked himself awake, staring around wildly into the dark, he knew he had come nearer to the edge of unconsciousness. Each time he expected to see the spider with the red mark on its belly bearing down on him, and saw nothing but the Hobbs, dancing orange in the distance. Heard nothing but the sough of the wind. But he waits. He bides. And if I sleep, when I sleep, he'll be on us. Around 3 in the morning, he roused himself by willpower alone from a doze that was on the very verge of tumbling him into deeper sleep. He looked around desperately, rubbing his eyes with the heels of his palms, hard enough to make murks and fowders and sancophytes explode across his field of vision. The fire had burned very low. Patrick lay about 20 feet from it, at the twisted base of a cottonwood tree. From where Roland sat, the boy was no more than a hide-covered hump. Of Oi, there was no immediate sign. Roland called to the bumbler, and got no response. The gunslinger was about to try his feet when he saw Jake's old friend a little beyond the edge of the failing firelight, or at least the gleam of his gold-ringed eyes. Those eyes looked at Roland for a moment, then disappeared, probably when Oi put his snout back down on his paws. "He's tired, too," Roland thought. "And why not?" The question of what would become of Oi after tomorrow tried to rise to the surface of the gunslinger's troubled, tired mind, and Roland pushed it away. He got up. In his weariness, his hands slipped down to his formerly troublesome hip, as if expecting to find the pain still there. Went to Patrick and shook him awake. It took some doing, but at last the boy's eyes opened. That wasn't good enough for Roland. He grasped Patrick's shoulders and pulled him up to a sitting position. When the boy tried to slump back down again, Roland shook him hard. He looked at Roland with dazed incomprehension.
"Help me build up the fire, Patrick."
Doing that should wake him up at least a little. And once the fire was burning bright again, Patrick would have to stand a brief watch. Roland didn't like the idea, knew full well that leaving Patrick in charge of the night would be dangerous. But trying to watch the rest of it on his own would be even more dangerous. He needed sleep. An hour or two would be enough, and surely Patrick could stay awake that long. Patrick was willing enough to gather up some sticks and put them on the fire, although he moved like a bogey, a reanimated corpse. And when the fire was blazing, he slumped back down in his former place with his arms between his bony knees, already more asleep than awake. Roland thought he might actually have to slap the boy to bring him around, and would later wish, bitterly, that he had done just that. "Patrick, listen to me." He shook Patrick by the shoulders hard enough to make his long hair fly, but some of it flopped back into his eyes. Roland brushed it away. "I need you to stay awake and watch. Just for an hour, just until— Look up, Patrick, look! Gods, don't you dare go to sleep on me again, do you see that? The brightest star of all those close to us?" It was Old Mother Roland was pointing to, and Patrick nodded at once. There was a gleam of interest in his eye now, and the gunslinger thought that was encouraging. It was Patrick's I-want-to-draw look. And if he sat drawing Old Mother as she shone in the widest fork of the biggest dead cottonwood, then the chances were good that he'd stay awake. Maybe until dawn, if he got fully involved. "Here, Patrick." He made the boy sit against the base of the tree. It was bony and knobby and, Roland hoped, uncomfortable enough to prohibit sleep. All these movements felt to Roland like the sort you made underwater. Oh, he was tired. So tired. "Do you still see the star?" Patrick nodded eagerly. He seemed to have thrown off his sleepiness, and the gunslinger thanked the gods for this favor. "When it goes behind that thick branch, and you can't see it or draw it any more without getting up, you call me. Wake me up, no matter how hard it is, do you understand?" Patrick nodded at once, but Roland had now traveled with him long enough to know that such a nod meant little or nothing. Eager to please, that's what he was. If you asked him if 9 and 9 made 19, he would nod with the same instant enthusiasm. "When you can't see it any more, from where you're sitting." His own words seemed to be coming from far away now. He'd just have to hope that Patrick understood. The tongueless boy had taken out his pad, at least, and a freshly sharpened pencil. "That's my best protection," Roland's mind muttered as he stumbled back to his little pile of hides between the campfire and Hofat too. "He won't fall asleep while he's drawing, will he?" He hoped not, but supposed he didn't really know. And it didn't matter, because he, Roland of Gilead, was going to sleep in any case. He'd done the best he could, and it would have to be enough. "An hour," he muttered, and his voice was far and wee in his own ears. "Wake me in an hour, when the star, when Old Mother
goes behind. But Roland was unable to finish. He didn't even know what he was saying anymore. Exhaustion grabbed him and bore him swiftly away into dreamless sleep. 7. Mordred saw it all through the far-seeing glass eyes. His fever had soared, and in its bright flame his own exhaustion had at least temporarily departed. He watched with avid interest as the gunslinger woke the mute boy, the artist, and bullied him into helping him build up the fire. He watched, rooting for the mute to finish this chore and then go back to sleep before the gunslinger could stop him. That didn't happen, unfortunately. They had camped near a grove of dead cottonwoods, and Roland led the artist to the biggest tree. Here he pointed up at the sky. It was strewn with stars, but Mordred reckoned old white gunslinger Daddy was pointing to old Mother because she was the brightest. At last, the artist, who didn't seem to be rolling a full barrow, at least not in the brains department, seemed to understand. He got out his pad and had already set to sketching as old white Daddy stumbled a little way off, still muttering instructions and orders to which the artist was pretty clearly paying absolutely no attention at all. Old white Daddy collapsed so suddenly that for a moment Mordred feared that perhaps the strip of jerky that served the son of a bitch as a heart had finally given up beating. Then Roland stirred in the grass, resettling himself, and Mordred, lying on a knoll about 90 yards west of the dry stream bed, felt his own heartbeat slow. And deep though the old white gunslinger Daddy's exhaustion might be, his training and his long lineage, going all the way back to the Eld himself, would be enough to awake him with his gun in his hand the second the artist gave one of his wordless but devilishly loud cries. Cramps seized Mordred, the deepest yet. He doubled over, fighting to hold his human shape, fighting not to scream, fighting not to die. He heard another of those long, flabbering noises from below, and felt more the lumpy brown stew begin coursing down his legs. But his preternaturally keen nose smelled more than excreta in this new mess. This time he smelled blood as well as shit. He thought the pain would never end, that it would go on deepening until it tore him in two, but at last it began to let up. He looked at his left hand, and was not entirely surprised to see that the fingers had blackened and fused together. They would never come back to human again, those fingers. He believed he had but only one more change left in him. Mordred wiped sweat from his brow with his right hand and raised the binoculars to his eyes again, praying to his red daddy that the stupid mutey boy would be asleep. But he was not. He was leaning against the cottonwood tree and looking up between the branches and drawing old Mother. That was the moment when Mordred Deshane came closest to despair. Like Roland, he thought drawing was the one thing that would likely keep the idiot boy awake. Therefore, why not give in to the change while he had the heat of this latest fever spike to fuel him with its destructive energy? Why not take his chance? It was Roland he wanted, after all, not the boy. Surely he could, in his spider form, sweep down on the gunslinger rapidly enough to grab him and pull him against the spider's craving mouth. Old White Daddy might get off one shot, possibly even two, but Mordred thought he could take one or two if the flying bits of lead didn't find the white node on the spider's back, his dual body's brain. And once I pull him in, I'll never let him go until he's sucked dry, nothing but a dust mummy, like the other one, Mia. He relaxed, ready to let the change sweep over him, and then another voice spoke from the center of his mind. It was the voice of his red daddy, the one who was imprisoned on the side of the Dark Tower and needed Mordred alive at least one more day in order to set him free. "Wait a little longer," this voice counseled. "Wait a little more. I might have another trick up my sleeve. Wait, wait, just a little longer." Mordred waited, and after a moment or two, he felt the pulse from the Dark Tower change.